Welcome to the Blue Sky Podcast,
brought to you by Cambridge University Science Magazine.
I'm Ruby.
And I'm Simone.
Every 2 weeks, we speak to local researchers, university staff and students, and anyone who works in science to learn about their research and activities, hear about the work that they do, and uncover what goes on behind the scenes.
If you want to get in touch with a question, suggestion, or just want to be featured on the podcast, just drop us a tweet. Our handle is at BlueSciPod.
And you can also email us at bluescipodcast@gmail.com. Happy Sunday, everyone!
A surprise from us, but you weren't expecting this episode. So we thought we'd make a special episode for International Women's Day. So first of all, happy International Women's Day.
Woo!
And we thought we would do something kind of highlighting a bit the work that's happening around us.
Yeah, because there's some absolutely incredible people doing some amazing things all around Cambridge just to promote women in the workplace and basically just try and really increase the amount of inclusion in the workplace. And yeah, we're really excited about it. So as well as all the other episodes that we're going to be giving you, this is an extra one
just
for free.
Just a little extra, just something special. Yeah, and we thought that since we already feature quite a lot of women on the podcast, we did want to make an episode where we had, like, you know, flash talks by different women in science, because we already, you know, are making a point to interview people from all different backgrounds in our podcast. And instead we thought that maybe our special episode could be about kind of some of the barriers that women and other minorities face in the workplace, specifically in STEM, how academia might be contributing to that, what role universities are playing, how students feel about it at university, how graduates, postgraduates, postdocs, just anyone, graduates, postgraduates, isn't that the same? That's the same thing. Yeah. Anyways, so how people across their careers, what are they doing to kind of, yeah, combat that, I guess.
Yeah.
So we have a very wide selection of things for you today.
Yeah, totally.
No.
So firstly, we spoke to Professor Rachel Oliver, and she works at the Department of Materials Sciences. And essentially, she set up an initiative called Tigers in STEM.
So, yeah, so she, the Tigers is the inclusion group for equity and research in STEM. I forgot the acronym during the interview, but I remembered it now.
So she was part of the team that came together on Twitter to get Parliament to launch an inquiry looking into grant and funding allocations in STEM.
So she's going to tell us all about that. We also spoke to Hope Bretcher, who is on the committee for Cavendish Inspiring Women, which is a student-led initiative which started, I think, 6 years ago in the Cavendish Laboratory in the Department of Physics. So that's what's called Cavendish Inspiring Women. And they're a student-led group of undergraduates, graduates, coming together to kind of provide support and mentorship and just events where people can come together and discuss their work and their lives. So yeah, she tells us all about that and how to start student-led kind of support networks at universities.
Yeah, she had loads of advice, actually, and if you want to set up something like this, she's got loads of advice for you if that's something you want to get going in your own workplace. And then lastly, we spoke to Rahila Roman, and she was the chair for the Cambridge AWISE initiative. AWISE is
the Association for Women in Science and Engineering.
Thank you, Simone.
No problem. I'm all about the acronyms today.
We chatted to her about what support can be given to women and people in minorities in returning to the workplace, and also sort of keeping a station in the workplace, you know, being confident, getting promotions, retaining people. And yeah, she had a lot of interesting stories and facts and figures that might surprise you.
So that's what we have for this episode. We hope you enjoy it. Please do rate, follow, subscribe, like, retweet, share, whatever.
Everything.
Just listen to the podcast and share it with the people that you think might enjoy it. And do write to us if you have any feedback or requests. Our email is bluescipodcast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear your reviews and thoughts. But we're going to stop chatting now, and we're going to get to the fundamental bit of the episode. So yeah, thanks for listening. So here we are with Professor Rachel Oliver. Thanks so much for meeting with us today. So you're a professor of material science and part of the Cambridge Centre for Gallium Nitride. And do you want to tell our listeners a bit about gallium nitride and why it's such an exciting material? Because you've worked on it since your PhD, and even now there's still more to look at.
So gallium nitride is exciting because it's the material that was found to work for blue light-emitting diodes. Now, it doesn't sound like such a big thing, so we've had red light-emitting diodes since maybe the 1960s, and these ones are blue, you know, what's the difference, really? The reason that blue light-emitting diodes are really technologically important, and the reason that three gentlemen, Akasaki, Amano, and Nakamura, got the Nobel Prize for the gallium nitride light-emitting diode, LED, in 2014, I think, is that this is the material, the colour of light, that then enables us to make white light. Okay, so we can make red light very easily, but because red light is less energetic than blue light, it's quite difficult to turn red light into blue light. Okay, whereas what we call down-converting, making more energetic light, blue light, into other colours, green, yellow and red, is much more straightforward. There are lots of materials that you can shine a light on and have it absorb that light and emit material of a longer wavelength or a lower energy. So that's why gallium nitride was key to allowing energy efficient solid state lighting to develop. And that's really why there's been such global interest in it for very many years. So the first LEDs were developed in the mid-90s from a material system that I think at the time people had almost written off, didn't really think was useful at all. They thought it was going to be far too difficult to make any kind of working device from it. And then very suddenly there was this development of these fantastic light-emitting diodes that really, the same kind of device designs with obviously quite a lot of development, underpin now the solid-state lighting industry. So huge amounts of other device development on other devices has gone on since then. There's loads of different directions that we might take gallium nitride, but that's really the start of the gallium nitride story. I actually didn't get into gallium nitride because I'm interested in LEDs. I got into it because I'm interested, well, my interests at the time, and still are, were in quantum dots, so very, very tiny crystals that have a quantum nature. So rather than emitting a whole lot of photons all at once, you can use them to get controlled emission of exactly one photon, so exactly one single quantum particle of light. But I guess the reason that they were interesting, gallium nitride is an interesting material for quantum dots, is because it's a really good light emitting material, and we know that from LEDs. So as I say, my starting point was wanting to make tiny nanostructures, quantum structures, and explore their properties. Making nanostructures in the nitrides is what my PhD is in. And then when I moved to Cambridge, I did get much more involved with the light emitting diode side of the field, particularly from a very kind of nanoscale point of view. So thinking about very, very tiny structure in these materials. So when I'm talking nano, I'm talking 1/1 billionth of a meter. Okay.
Wow.
Or maybe think of it as like taking the width of a human hair and dividing that by a million. That might be a useful way of thinking about it. So it turns out, so I came at the nitrides from this very, very small crystals point of view. But it turns out that nitride light-emitting diodes and lots of nitride devices have very interesting structure right down at that scale. Many materials do, so maybe it's not surprising. But particularly for the nitrides, the performance of light-emitting diodes is very much tied up in their very small scale structure. So I kind of brought my interest in the nanoscale world, the very tiny structure, into the more conventional aspects in terms of light-emitting diodes and laser diodes and other light emitters in the nitrides. And really that's kind of at the core of my all of the research in my career and all the science that I do. I'm interested in understanding ways that we can understand the very, very small structure of these materials, and then figuring out from that understanding how we can improve the materials or make new devices, how we can exploit variations in very, very small structure in these materials to do useful things. And in my group at the moment, that is still about better and better, better and cheaper, I guess, light emitting diodes. I'm also interested in using these materials in electronics to switch power, so essentially helping to change power levels from high voltages to lower voltages, or higher currents to lower currents, or vice versa, and also for manipulating and sending information, those sorts of electronic devices, but again with my primary interest being at the very, very small scale. And I'm still very, very interested in quantum dots and devices that emit single quantum particles, single quantum packages of light. And that's obviously a technology that is rather further from the kind of mass market than light emitting diodes, but there's lots of fun science in that space. And really, I'm interested in anything in the nitrides where we can manipulate the very small scale structure and use it to get useful function. So recently we've also been thinking about things like energy harvesting, so using these materials to capture energy from kind of vibrations or your sort of stamping with your feet or those sorts of things. We've been thinking about combining the properties of these light emitting materials with magnetic materials. There's a whole big space you can operate in about small scale structure and manipulating that to do useful stuff.
So it sounds like this field has a lot of opportunity to move into lots of different directions, both with regard to fundamental science as well as applications of that. And so you came to Cambridge as a postdoc and you've been here ever since. How do you find Cambridge? You're now a professor. What's the journey been like? What's the path been?
So I came as a junior research fellow at Peterhouse. Although in fact they call their, they don't use the word junior research fellow, they say research fellow, but so funded by Peterhouse. And the advantage of what are broadly referred to as junior research fellowships is that you can come and do much more your own science than you might arriving on a normal postdoctoral contract where maybe somebody else has written a project and you need to follow along the track that they've laid down. So that was a fantastic opportunity. I was really, really lucky to get that opportunity. Then after that, I was a Royal Society University Research Fellow, which is also a research fellowship, but that means that you have more of your own funding to do your own research, and it's a longer term thing, and you're essentially treated as a member of the academic staff, which is also a fantastic opportunity. The other thing that's great about that is the Royal Society also provides you with other opportunities for things like media training, communications training. I spent some time learning about outreach in the school sense, which is something I've done a lot of since, and they provide training courses and really kind of nice hands-on training opportunities.
More support in that sense.
Compared to some schemes, there's more support to develop you as an all-round, both I guess an all-round person, but also the sort of the skills that get missed out but that are useful to professional scientists about communications and things like that. They do a really good job of helping you develop. And from that was when I applied for a lectureship here and took up my kind of notionally permanent position here in Cambridge. I think Cambridge is a really exciting environment to work in because there are a lot of very, very clever people here doing really exciting science. So one of the things I like about the university is the extent to which you can find collaborators across the university doing a whole range of different things, and that people are able to engage with your science on a lot of different levels. I think the way we teach here is very, very intense. It can mean that term times are really very, very busy, and sometimes that means that you can't engage with the breadth of science going on here as well as you might like, and that you maybe let your collaborators down a little bit. Maybe I'm criticising myself more than my collaborators there. So it has its ups and downs, but it's certainly a really fantastic environment to kind of do kind of wide-ranging and hopefully high-impact science.
So you said that you've been involved in kind of science outreach and communication projects as well, and you've also been one of the founders of this group, the inclusion group.
For equity and research in STEM.
Exactly, do you want to tell us a bit about how that started and what kind of prompted your interest in, not necessarily interest, but what kind of gave the momentum for that group to form?
So essentially that group kind of coalesced out of the work I was doing with others around this My Science Inquiry process. So My Science Inquiry is a initiative of the House of Commons Select Committee for Science and Technology. Okay. And all of the select committees essentially conduct inquiries into areas that they think are of national importance and then make recommendations to government as to changes that should be made, either legislatively or policy changes of various sorts. And the Science and Technology Select Committee, starting a few years ago now, it's not how they used to run things, but they've done it a couple of times, they decided that they would ask the broader community for suggestions as to what were the kind of hot button issues around science and technology that they ought to be holding inquiries into. And that process is called hashtag My Science Inquiry, because it's promoted largely via Twitter. A thing I learned in a useful training run for me, in fact, in the university, was that parliamentary select committees do an awful lot of advertising their business via Twitter, and think Twitter is a very useful tool, which is one of the reasons I personally got into Twitter, so that I could hear about what they were up to. But it wasn't something I expected. I thought it was all, you know, Twitter struck me as a bit frivolous and parliamentary select committees as very serious, and I wasn't really sure that the two would cross over, but they do a lot of business that way. So this My Science Inquiry process, I actually had been in touch with the select committee about issues around funding for research and diversity previously, and therefore the clerks of the committee gave me a bit of a warning and said, this process is coming up, and you know, we know you're someone with an interest in this space, maybe you'd like to put a proposal together for a inquiry into some of these issues around diversity. And I knew quite a lot of people who were interested in diversity issues, again largely via Twitter, and pretty much via a I'm doing this, who'd like to help kind of tweet, we brought a small group of people together to write this short proposal. And I guess the sort of starting brief was, oh well, something to do with diversity in science. But one of my personal interests in that space is in the funding mechanisms. I've been asking questions for quite a long time about like what the data tells us about where the money goes. And there is some data, but some of it is quite deceptive in some ways. So for example, in the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, if you look at success rates, the success rates for men and women are not that different. But there was an FOI request went in which was looking at the amounts of funding rather than the success rate.
Right.
Yeah.
And in a particular year that this FOI request looked at, which I think was 2017, it turned out that the EPSRC's applicant cohort is about 20% women, but only about 7% of the funding went to women.
Oh wow.
Okay. So those are stark differences, but it doesn't show up in success rate because it's about who gets the big grant. You're asking the wrong question. So I really wanted the select committee to think about, like, do we really know whether there are disparities in how we're giving out funding? And if there are, what are the causes of them and what can we do about them?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a space which is really controlling in science. Okay, so at all stages, obviously, you have to fund your research, whether that's having a studentship to fund doing your PhD, through to if I want to run a major research centre, obviously, I need quite a lot of money for the people we employ, for the equipment we use, for the maintenance of the equipment we use, for the very large volume of consumables we get through. So at all scales, that really matters. And if there are places where, because of the way we run the system, or because of biases in the people who are reviewing proposals, that it's much more difficult as a woman, or as a black person, or as a disabled person, to get that money, it's an absolute barrier to taking your science forward, because it affects, you know, you can't get stuff done, so therefore you don't write your good papers, you don't get invited to speak at conferences, you don't have good things to put on your promotion application, you're kind of stuck. And you more simply can't explore your ideas, however exciting they may be. So I saw that as a key kind of potential enabler of a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That if we can make sure the funding flow is fair, then that enables people to go out and do their science really well, which then helps them to climb up the career ladder and kind of provides role models, moves everything forward.
Yeah, and because also you want to make sure that the systems that you're using to evaluate whether or not, you know, one type of science is funded, you want it to be fair, and you want it to be a reflection of the actual work and not necessarily the biases that you have as an institution, right? So
yeah, absolutely. So it's about fairness. It's also pragmatically about, like, we need more scientists. Okay, there are areas in which there are skill shortages which are just crying out for there to be more, for example, material scientists available. The government is talking about greatly increasing the proportion of GDP which is spent on science research in the broad sense. You need trained individuals to carry that through. And that means you can't be losing significant chunks of your population out of science because they can't get money to do the things they need to do. You need to retain people. And we talk a lot when we talk about sort of improving the proportion of women in science about how we get more young women in. And equally, if you're talking about ethnic minorities, you know, how do we make this an attractive career to students from ethnic minority backgrounds or from different socioeconomic backgrounds? But it's all pointless if you can get people in at the start, but you're not running a system that allows you to retain those people. And if we don't retain those people, we can't fill in these skills gaps because there simply aren't enough people. So yeah, from fairness point of view, from a actual practicality, kind of what the nation needs point of view, I saw this as really important. And that's basically what we attempted to persuade the Science and Technology Committee of. So what we pitched was an inquiry into the impact of funding policy on equality, diversity, inclusion and accessibility in the science community. I went and actually gave a pitch, I guess, a little speech for the committee in the Houses of Parliament, which was quite nerve-wracking, I have to say. There were 100 or so initial proposals. 10 went to that kind of pitching meeting, and in the end they are doing 3 inquiries coming from that, and it took a couple of months, I think, but in the end they decided that our inquiry would be one of those.
So your speech went well?
Yeah. So that's kind of the process. That's the most of my science inquiry process. It's also the process that brought the group of people who became the core of TIGERS, the Inclusion Group for Equity and Research in STEM, together. I think, firstly, having gathered this group of people together who were so enthusiastic about pushing the My Science Inquiry thing forwards, you automatically had a group of people who were interested in these diversity issues, and it suddenly started being, oh, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? Can we also do this? We felt that if we drew together some kind of grouping, we could support one another to do more of that. We could support other people, bring in other members to the group. And I think also one of the things we've done that I'm increasingly thinking is important is we use our social media platforms, principally Twitter, to just have quite open discussions about some of these issues. And I think what we're finding is that some of these things just go unsaid, that the sorts of things that are actually problems are just kind of ignored or overlooked because nobody's talking about them and there aren't good spaces to talk about them. So just having open discussions means that the people who need to know can come and see our discussions and see the themes that are coming up. We can communicate the things that we think are core themes from those discussions to the different funding bodies and universities we're trying to influence. But it also just changes the culture. It says, rather than this is how things are and you all have to cope with it, it says, like, this is something we can talk about, we can talk openly about it, and we can talk about how we achieve change. And I think that's quite important as well.
Starting those conversations is often the hardest part of it, I think, especially if someone's in a minority group or feel like they haven't been listened to for all sorts of other reasons, not even in their career, but in all sorts of other ways. So yeah, I think it's really amazing to bring this issue to light. And so in terms of the inquiry, is it still ongoing or was it...
Oh, politics. Is it? Okay. So I would explain. So they selected it to take forward and they said that it would start within the next 6 months or a year from when they said it was one of the ones that had been chosen. What the TIGERS did as a group was we tried to engage the clerks of the committee to talk about like how the terms of reference would be set to make sure that the inquiry which happened had some link to our original vision of what was needed. As a result of that, we talked to them about the kind of data we thought ought to be being analysed in terms of how you look at these funding questions. They sent a list of questions to the UKRI, so the overarching body for most of the research funding in the UK, and who did answer them. And it felt like, I'm not saying that the UKRI's answers necessarily answered all our questions, but it felt like the UKRI were engaging, which was excellent. It felt like we were making progress towards really putting this question on the agenda. Then Boris Johnson called a snap general election. And what happens when you have an election is that the business of the committee stops, obviously, everything stops for the election. But when they come back, they re-elect new committees who set new agendas. So at the moment, the Science and Technology Committee has a chair, but there is no committee. And we are waiting for the new committee to materialise and to find out whether they will or won't take this inquiry forward. Norman Lamb, who was the chair of the previous committee, wrote to his kind of, at that stage, not existent successor, saying, this is what the committee was working on, and we would suggest you do take these things forward. We have committed to doing this work. And Tigers have since coordinated a letter, which I think got around 400 signatures, which is to the new chair of the committee, Dr. Greg Clark, to say, we really still think this is important. Please consider putting this high up on your agenda for the new parliament. And now we wait.
Keep our fingers crossed for that, yeah.
Yeah, and we will continue to put on such pressure as we can to keep this going forward.
And why do you think that it's taken, you know, people coming together on Twitter talking about these things to submit this to the parliament to change that conversation and bring diversity to that agenda? I mean, you would think that, you know, universities or these research councils would know about, obviously they are the ones that have the data, they're the ones that give out the funding. Isn't it also in their interest to find that out?
So to be fair to UKRI, they are greatly increasing the amount of effort they're putting into the diversity question. So UKRI is effectively a new organisation, kind of stemming over various other research councils, so Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, Medical Research Council, Biological and something Research Council, all these different ones, various. There's several others as well that I haven't managed to list there. And that there's a much stronger sort of diversity leadership team in place now than there has been in the past. And there are also embedded diversity efforts in each research council, some of which are doing excellent work. But I think science has been doing, or academia has been doing its thing the way it does for a very long time. It's quite difficult for the people who, as their professional activity, are trying to push diversity forward, because they may get pushed back against that from the people who are effectively vested interests in this space. And I think the thing that they hear a lot is, we shouldn't be talking about, you know, how we bring forward more women or more ethnic minorities or more disabled people, because it's all on merit and that's all there is to it, and there's nothing to worry about because everything's about excellence and it's all on merit. And perhaps it's difficult to see, if you aren't somebody who's been minoritised in your own life, the things that suggest to you that, no, it's not really all on merit, and just saying it's fine because it's all on merit doesn't cover it. But that pushback comes continuously against people who are trying to make progress in this space. And I think that's why it's important that there are groups of people coalescing who are pushing from the other direction, who are saying, no, this matters, and it matters not just because it's not fair to the minoritised individuals involved. It matters because you're not doing as good a science as you could be because we're not addressing these issues. And it needs, there's a lot of inertia and a lot of people sort of stood going, no, it's all fine. So you need the people saying, No, it's not. And we need to make change, and we are passionate about this and we care about this, for there to be essentially almost a lobby group to kind of have the interests of this as their priorities, allows the research councils, when they're doing good work, to say, no, you know, just because you say that, that isn't how the community as a whole feels. There are people who really want to push this forward. If we don't speak up, it's very, very difficult for the people in the kind of more administrative roles to take this stuff on without the support of the community behind them.
Mm. So obviously the Tigers initiative is powered by people like yourself who are taking time out of their research days and their personal lives to really drive something, and it's incredible. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on initiatives such as Athena Swan were, because kind of in a way, if those initiatives were kind of being as successful as they ought to be, then you wouldn't have to be having to drive something like this yourself. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were, whether it's now become more of a tick box rather than a true initiative.
So I think Athena Swan has done some very valuable things, okay? One thing that's worth saying is that Athena Swan works kind of within the university context, and a lot of the things that I'm worrying about are the things that are external to the university that influence the university. So it's not necessarily that Athena Swan ever had any intention to try and solve the things that I've been putting a lot of effort into myself recently. I think Athena Swan got everybody talking about diversity in the universities, very much on the gender front, and diversity is not just gender.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's now the Race Equality Charter. One of the things about Athena Swan, whilst it did get the conversation started in a very important fashion, is I think it was very lacking in thinking about the kind of intersectional aspects. So I'm in many ways, as a white woman from a middle-class background, a very privileged person, and I'm aware of that, but I don't think Athena Swan had much awareness when it started about the differences there might be between navigating this space as a white middle-class woman and potentially navigating this space as a black working-class woman. And that is a gap, I think, I hope that they're starting to fill, but has been something that's been a bit missed out. I think it was very good in getting everybody to actually get organised and know what they were doing. So we talk about it as a tick box exercise sometimes, as a sort of pejorative, but there were boxes that were not being filled in. We didn't necessarily know, you know, what proportion of our postdoc applicants were female and what proportion of our employed postdocs were female. Now, if we're hardly employing any female postdocs, that's a problem, but it could be a problem because we're not attracting the right applicants, or it could be a problem because we're not appointing an appropriate range of people. We need to know which, and Athena Swan got us looking at questions like that, and it's important. So that aspect of it's been excellent. I think the thing that's concerned me about it is this tendency to reinvent the wheel. So they're very keen on making these action plans, and you're meant to each have each department come up with an action plan. But in terms of a lot of the stuff that they've caused us to do well, I feel by this point there should be best practice in this space, and everybody should just be doing that best practice, and nobody should be needing to invent an action plan. So there's an extent to which I feel things like Athena Swan maybe need to mature and take the gathered knowledge from many, many action plans that have come in to that scheme and say, okay, well, there will need to be like specific local action that works for the very specific context on some things, but there are things everybody should be doing, and here they are.
It seems like it was a good conversation starter at the very least when it came about, but now there's other initiatives having to bulk out the rest of.
And I think Athena Swan is in the midst of a big review.
Mm.
A lot of people like me, I think, have said roughly what I just said,
yeah,
about it to them. Hopefully it will go on to even greater things. It's done good, it can do more good.
Well, thanks for taking the time to chat to us this morning. So we're talking to Hope Brecher, who is a co-president of Cavendish Inspired Women, which is a student-led group based in the physics department in Cambridge, working towards improving the visibility of women in physics. And yeah, in case you don't know, the Cavendish is the physics department in Cambridge. So thanks, Hope, for being here.
Would you be able to like chat to us a bit about Cambridge? It's Cavendish Inspiring Women.
Yeah. So I've been, so it started probably now actually close to 6 years ago. And since then, we've usually had sort of two people in some ways acting as co-presidents, I guess. There's usually two kind of co-presidents that is now like sort of more formalized because we have a constitution and in our uni society. But I've been involved since probably about the start of my second year. So for 3 years-ish,
mm-hmm.
kind of as a co-president now with sort of two different people as the other one. So, yeah.
Cool. And what does this initiative do? What's its main sort of aims?
So I think I was thinking about this because you sent me the questions. But I think there's a couple different things that we've been trying to do. So I think initially when Hannah and Sarah started it, the main thing that they were focusing on was building community. Because there were kind of feelings of isolation and stuff, they wanted to start having events so that women could come together and meet each other. And then from that, it sort of seem to progress more as well to keeping that community aspect, but also trying to raise the profile of women in physics. So we've kind of continued that by still having a lot of talks by, I guess, both women scientists and by people that do things related to science. So we're having an author who's coming and speaking, Zia Morali, who did her PhD in the Cavendish and is now, I think, writes books, but also does a lot of different news, science, news journalism type writing. So it's kind of the community aspect, then raising the profile of women as scientists and as kind of experts in their fields. And then I think there's a side that is just trying to support women and non-binary students and staff. Both, I guess, I don't think we do a ton probably for like very senior staff, but at both undergrad, grad and post-grad levels, I would say. And then the last thing is probably one that I have been more interested in as well is, I don't know if social justice side of thing is the right thing, but just even some things behind the scenes or really trying to say, you know, other than just, you know, providing community is one thing, but how do we actually also try to tackle issues that are sort of causing the need for that to exist, for those support structures to exist? Can we actually cause structural change? Which I don't think I can say we've, you know, like reformulated the cabinet or anything. That's not true. But I think we should be thinking about that as a group, and so we've been doing that as well.
And what kind of issues have you been thinking about or trying to address, I guess?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I was writing down things. I think one thing that Akila, who I actually, really since I've started, so initially I was working with Carmen and Ankita, and then in the past 2 years it's been working with Ankita, is now graduated, as is Carmen, and working with Akila. So it was kind of looking at how CIW is Cavendish Inspiring Women, but how do we make sure that we're not just supporting, I guess for me, white women or straight women? How do we also look for supporting people who are queer or non-binary and also people of color? Because especially like up to this point, now I think it's changing, but the Cavendish has really only sort of done the like support gender thing and hasn't had a lot of other things or support structures. And so I think as a group, we've really wanted to say, you know, in some ways we have a position where we have funding and we have a voice, and how do we use that to make sure that we're trying to, I don't know, not reproduce the same power structures to change the system and to kind of work to supporting, scientists of all different backgrounds and building a system that actually is supportive of that, as opposed to, I don't know, there's all these like sayings of like, do you have a seat at the table and all this, and like inclusivity I think is a really good word, but
if it's just a word, then you need
something. Just like, you know, we have this system and you're getting invited to be there, like we should be thinking about what do we want science to be and how do we actually create that and imagine that as a space. So that's I guess what is on my mind is,
You said before that you have undergraduates, graduates, postgraduates. How does that kind of interaction work? Because the network is the idea kind of to bring those people together into the same space or to provide like mentorship?
Yeah,
how
so
does that work?
I think it's kind of a couple of different ways. So, so on the kind of community side of thing, we tried to have a lot of different social events. So weekly tea times, which actually now I think are kind of picking up steam, which makes me really happy because originally it was usually like just me and somebody else who was on the CIW board. And now we've had some where there's 10 or 12 people from undergrad, probably up to, through postdocs. I think that's nice because now I think only part two actually have lectures here.
So that's third year.
So I think first and second might have labs or practicals, but they're often just not at the Cavendish. So we haven't had as much attendance from those years. There's been a lot of kind of third year and master's level students who have come. We often have postdocs there. And then last term and this term, we've also started inviting, just trying to have lunch with different speakers who are here either for CIW or for invited for other lectures in the Cavendish. And those have also, I think, been really successful and have gotten more undergrads from all different levels there. I think prior to this year, which we're still planning on having one, we've had formals, so stuff like that, where really we're getting all these different levels in kind of the same place. And then we also have been running a mentorship program that I think has also been doing pretty... We've tried to figure out how to, like, you know, how to evaluate the effectiveness, which is really hard. But sometimes, you know, you hear these anecdotes of like, oh, yeah, you know, like there's a couple group of women that have been... So I think there was like three tiers of an undergrad, a postgrad, and then a postdoc, and a higher postdoc or something. And the four of them go out to lunch now every week.
Oh, wow.
Or like meet up for lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, after being kind of matched as mentors last year. So So sometimes you hear these, like, you know, like,
and I guess in general, if you think that people are happy with as long as you get, like, positive feedback in general about the program, like, maybe it's not going to, like, change someone's life, but it still provides that small support that actually does make a difference and, like, reminds you that you know, there are all these different things that you could be doing.
Yeah. I know for me, I mean, I think it's been, like, I guess it's the only, it's been helpful for me because I feel like I've met so many women that I don't know if I would have if I'd, like, just was kind of existing within my own group, which there have been, there are, I'm, like, my group is actually fairly gender diverse for physics, but I think it's, for me, it's just, like, feels so much less isolating to know these people and know them from all around the Cavendish as well, because that groups don't tend to talk,
areas of physics
so.
And different levels as well, like, what do you think the impact of, because you were chatting about, like, having undergraduates, masters, PhDs and postdocs all mixing together. Do you think that's actually really powerful? Because, for instance, if there's an undergraduate that's considering doing a sort of research career and they are in contact with very regularly, you know, senior postdocs, do you think that that's going to have an effect in the number of sort of women, you know, continuing their research and continuing their physics sort of education.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think the goal is that then you sort of have, I think somebody had said, what was it, like, tiered mentoring, I think, or tiered role models in some ways. So I was working with a woman who's making videos about women from the Cavendish, or different physicists. And the idea there was really to highlight people at each stage of the career, because a lot of times, you know, often, you know, you'll put up this role model and, like, Joycelyn Bell Burnell is amazing. And I think everybody loves to go hear her speak. But when you're, you know, an undergrad and you hear somebody like her, you're like, how can I ever get there? Like, it's inspiring, but it's also really intimidating. So having kind of the person that's just one step ahead of you, I think, is really helpful, because you're able to say, like, oh, I can see myself doing that. And, you know, you can hear about those challenges and those decisions in a way that's a lot more relatable to the situation that you're currently in.
Yeah.
And I guess it's also interesting that, like, because those are people that maybe you would be too intimidated to just email. And, like, often people are really, really happy to chat, but you just don't have the space to interact with people from different groups. So I guess having that, like, framework to actually talk to postdocs, and they're there for you.
Yeah.
And not be like, hello, random person on the internet, what do you think about this?
And then also maybe, you know, they might know somebody, so once you start that conversation, then they're able to introduce you to, like, oh, I mean, have you talked to this person or that? And I think that can be really helpful, so.
Yeah. I think also just, like, recognizing that people are human in a way.
Yeah.
So, like, if you are sort of interacting with people on more of a social level, as well as, you know, getting advice and chatting about science, you know, you can sort of say, oh, you know, I have to leave work early on Tuesday and I just sit in my pajamas and, like, you know, whatever. Like, it's just really nice to have that human aspect of it and realize that, you know, I think everyone has this kind of picture in their head that everyone else is working so much harder than you and doing so much better than you.
Yeah.
And it's, you feel like you're always chasing people, whereas if you can sort of all sort of share, like, a nice space where you feel safe as well,
yeah,
it must be good, like, especially in such a male-dominated field. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other thing that was one time helpful is we had an event last year for one of the, you know, the colleges will have these, like, events for high schoolers to come in, or sorry, secondary school students to come and be at Cambridge for a couple of weeks and to have lectures or whatever. So there was one that was focused on maths, and they came to the Cavendish and we kind of showed them around and had some talks and stuff. But we had a PhD student from DAMPT, so from, like, math theory, come and speak. And in some ways, I was really happy to hear, because, like, one, I don't actually know what a theorist does every day as an experimentalist. But she was also really nice, because she kind of was talking about, you know, you don't have to be, feel like you're, a, you know everything about math or have, like, this special gift necessarily to pursue this as a field. Like, if you like it and you're interested, the thing is that you're going to go and learn, and then you're going to find these new directions to go into. Because, yeah, from my perspective, even as, like, an experimental physicist, to be a theorist, you have to have this, like, special insight and grasp of conceptual math that is intimidating to me. And so hearing somebody be like, no, you know, you just learn it. And you sort of have to have the interest and maybe the motivation.
Because otherwise you're not going to be motivated to do all the work to learn it.
Yeah, but it's not that you're, like, you have this innate gift. And I think that is is a good thing to to keep reinforcing to people, is like, you know, you'll learn and grow in that way. You don't have to be born
knowing knowing theoretical physics. Oh.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And what do you think, have you interacted with other similar groups at other universities, or have you heard about other groups?
Yeah.
Is that something that you're thinking about? Or
yeah, in
really?
Some ways. So I think for me, probably the main way that I've sort of heard what other people are doing in is through like Twitter and through certain networks on there. So I think you're aware of it, but the Tiger in STEM group, which I, you know, saw in a post on early, and so kind of somehow got in the early days of putting all those proposals together. That's been really helpful because there's all these people from different universities, mostly around the UK, who are each involved in some sort of diversity or equality work in some way. And some of that is through student groups, but some of them are also, you know, like deans of equality at their institutions. So being able to learn from them and see what they're doing and how they're approaching things has been, is really helpful. And then, yeah, I think sometimes, you know, you get a chance to catch up with people. So there's a young woman who has the same funding source that I originally came to the UK with. So she's also American. And she, I think, started kind of a group for women in physics at Stanford. And so we had dinner one night, and it was so nice to just be able to compare and talk about what had worked and what hadn't, and what they had tried. So, yeah, so that is really useful.
And do you think that that could be something that could be useful in the future to talk about, to talk with different universities, kind of pool that information together, what could be helpful? What?
Yeah, I think so. I think we'd have to think of, how do we facilitate those conversations?
Yeah. What are the kind of future plans? Because you said that you're in your fourth year, you're wrapping things up.
Yeah, so I think, I saw that question, I was like, I don't know. Because I think really I'm probably looking at next term, I think we're going to have elections and somebody else is going to take over. So I haven't been probably planning for the future as much as I did in past years, just because I know that it's going to be up to other people to sort of take it forward. And I think, in some ways, I think that's good because every person that's led CIW, I think, has different ideas and different interests, which is great, because then, like, one, that allows you as an individual to sort of, like, you know, sort of direct it in the way that you think is interesting, but it also means that we bring new perspectives in and, you know, kind of either, I guess, not always expand what we do, but sort of change directions, which I think is useful, so. I don't know where it will be next year.
I guess we'll find out.
And I guess if anyone listening wants to get involved, then it sounds like now's a good time to start thinking.
It's
about
an amazing time. I mean, really, I think I put this on every one of the emails that I write.
Yeah.
Just like, if you have ideas or want to do something, like, get in contact with us. Yeah, so if somebody has an idea or thinks that there's something we can do better, because really, you know, any sort of feedback on the things we are doing already is really helpful, so.
And what would you say to someone that is listening from another university or
is
thinking of setting up something similar or like a kind of small network in their university for women? What would you say to them?
I would say it takes a bit of time and to get it going. So I think initially, for example, when we had this tea time sessions, as I said, for probably quite a while, it was sort of just the people organizing it that showed up. But then I think now it's gaining momentum and really kind of getting to be a weekly routine that I really like and I think other people are really valuing. So I think you sort of have to stick it out in some ways and just keep being enthusiastic, which can be hard because at some point you're like, you know, like you feel like people are like, oh, it's a great idea, but then nobody comes. And that can be really demotivating.
Yeah.
But it just takes time and... I guess the other thing is feel free to reach out, I guess, to CIW, but to other universities, as you said, because I think they might have some useful information or connections or different things like that. So I think one thing that's been good for us is that the department is very supportive, and that, you know, we're not usually facing any sort of pushback from that. As you said, they give us funds and, I guess, given their approval for us to do the things that we try. And I can imagine it would be a lot harder if you don't have that support.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, like, do you think that the support that you get from the university or the department is good? Which I guess you answered yes.
Yeah,
so that's nice.
For the most part. I think what I wish would happen sometimes is that it's a hard balance, and I think that they don't understand how to do this, which I don't know the answer. You know, if you have groups like CIW that's trying to, you know, build a community or raise a profile or whatever. It's really great, but it means that the people that are already sort of marginalized in some way are the ones that are doing a lot of the legwork.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how do you start to share that burden? And I don't know if that is working super well in the department. I think they're aware of it. Like, I know they're aware of it, but how do you change that? And mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And it goes back to sort of these structural things, is how do you make sure that you're sort of balancing these things, that it's not just putting the burden on
Because, I mean, you're all volunteers, you're all students who do this just because you feel like it's something important that you should do, but that obviously takes time away from other things that you could be doing.
Yeah, precisely.
And if you didn't feel like this was something that was important to you or wasn't affecting you, then you'd have all this free time to work on whatever else.
So one thing I wish, and it's hard to say if this is, I don't know, changing or at all important, but it feels like when you hear about, you know, going to careers in science, like this kind of work is not really that valued. And so in some ways, like, you know, I feel like on a resume, you know, I can put a lot of skills of things that I've done for CIW, and like now I've been on committees, and like those things I'm sure will be sort of helpful. But at the same time, you're right, like it sort of seems like a lot of times people are like, well, it really just matters how many papers you have for certain things, for certain levels, and you know, maybe I'm missing out on that. And for the most part, I feel like I'm glad of the choice that I made, because I think I would not be happy, or I would just struggle a lot more if I didn't have this network. But at the same time, I think that's kind of the challenge where, again, as you go back to sort of saying, how do we envision a better science and a better system of science? I think that means that we need to say, what do we value of scientists? And right now, I think kind of work of looking at how do we support a community and support the people in those is not being valued, and something that is maybe, you know, being included when you're
like
looking at hiring.
As opposed to a requisite. Something important.
And there's a positive feedback thing as well. Like you said, that you've put an awful lot of time into this, and you know, it's a shame that it's not, it, you know, employers would kind of overlook it in a way.
Yeah.
But if someone did want to set up something like this, it sounds like it's sort of a mixture of starting small, persevering, and not being afraid to ask for help.
And I guess as the years go on and you get more like alumni, you know,
that
would be quite nice to have not just people that you invite to speak, but people that used to be in the position of when people are actually attending these things. I feel like that's always quite fun when you're like, oh, the person that's speaking at this event was in my position 10 years ago.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, everybody's kind of bringing their expertise and the things they've learned to where they go next. So I guess I named the people that have sort of been the leaders, but there's been a lot of people who have been involved in various ways and various roles. And so I hope as we sort of graduate and leave and move on and get positions places that, we'll carry on this work in each of those locations. Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us.
I know, that's great.
And yeah, it's been really interesting to learn about sort of the initiative that all of you have sort of put together.
A lot of opportunities to get involved. Just send us an email at cavendishiw@gmail.com.
And what's your website?
Our website is cavendishinspiringwomen.co.uk.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, cool. Thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you.
So we're very excited to have Rahila Raymond with us, who's the chair of the Cambridge Association for Women in Science and Engineering, so CAMAYS. Thanks for meeting with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell our listeners a bit about CAMAYS and kind of the work that you do, your role there, and what the purpose of the organisation is?
Well, CAMAYS is a voluntary organisation. It's a regional network for women in STEM, and it straddles both industry and academia. First came out of Cambridge University with a couple of academics from Lucy Cavendish College, and over the years, as Cambridge itself has grown, and as you know, the Cambridge phenomena of the companies and the spin-outs, as that's grown, that's been brought in. And so we support recruitment, then the retention of women, and their promotion and return back to STEM careers after a break. And we bring back together women with a common interest. So we'll act as a source of support, provide information and inspiration. And we aim to help women stay in STEM, you know, make the most of their careers. And we do that by providing regular workshops, training, talks, networking opportunities, And a lot of items are given through our website and newsletter. So that kind of is a broad brush up on what CAMEWISE does.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that you offer support for people to come back, is that in, I don't know, helping them write applications or providing funding or showing them where funding is available or things like that?
It can be anything. Mm-hmm. Most of the time it is someone having been away for a while and wanting to get back into the swing of things. They may need to retrain and start looking at what's available. And one of the best ways to find out what might be available is networking. And we often forget how powerful that tool is. I mean, you can fall on two sides of the coin of networking. You really, really would rather not do it, or you kind of embrace that opportunity and, find the exciting side of meeting new people and maintaining those relationships. And you may have heard the figure that 80 to 85% of jobs out there are not even advertised. They're usually promoted by the word of mouth, or somebody will be headhunted. So again, you can't iterate enough how important networking is. So we provide that space specifically for networking.
Wow, I had no idea about the 85% aren't even advertised. That's absolutely staggering.
Yes.
And sort of how does Cambridge AWISE interact with university and institutions? Like how do you work with them to sort of, deliver this support?
So, CAMEWISE creates collaborations with the university and the departments, and the engagement is one of our successes. We're embedded within the university, and our membership includes both university and non-university members. So we are quite embedded in the university, and we do have a reputation of having strong links with institutions across Cambridge and beyond. And we're often approached by various institutions to go and work alongside them.
So then you work also with companies, you said, not
yes.
just the university.
Yes, we do. The companies may approach us to set up a corporate membership.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun way for their employees to go out there and get professional training, whilst at the same time create their networks of this amazing setup in Cambridge of other people that are not necessarily in your sector, in another sector.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know what kind of conversations or innovations can spring out of those.
Bring people from different areas together.
Absolutely, yeah.
So is it companies mainly that work on STEM related things, or? So I guess you are AWISE with
yes.
science and engineering.
It does tend to be people with STEM backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also get people who are science communicators,
mm-hmm.
work in publishing. It does bring in a wide variety of people.
Wow, that's great.
So it sounds like you provide kind of the support that people need in different stages of whatever they're doing. And
yes.
then that acts as a springboard for what
yes.
they want to do. And we
don't act as a recruitment service.
Mm-hmm.
We won't put people together in that manner. What we will do is try and put people in the same space and same room for them to talk to each other, and then they can reach out and let each other know if somebody's looking for a post or if they know something's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it works pretty well.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, it must really help with confidence as well, because if you are returning to the workplace after a career break, I can't imagine, even if I have a few weeks off to go on holiday, and when I come back, I have no idea what's going on.
You're like, talking to my notes,
yeah.
like, what happened this week?
I have no idea what it's like to come back after such a long career break, and it's really good to know that there's sort of a service kind of there to help people grow in confidence and sort of reach for the roles that they can do,
because that they're completely qualified to
totally.
They just need a little refresher.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, that is one of the key things. The key
mm-hmm.
skill is confidence.
Mm-hmm.
As women will tend to shy away from applying for a post because they don't feel that they fulfill the full criteria.
Mm-hmm.
It's just creating that confidence
mm-hmm.
In your own ability that you can do. And if you have a small gap,
mm-hmm.
you can go and come along to the CAMEWISE training, or go away and pick up on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting as well, because you're
I suppose if there were a more mature student that is perhaps wanting to take a career break and they're networking with people that have taken career breaks and come back into it and it's not been a problem and they've been supported, then I guess it sort of increases the likelihood of them staying on in that field, even if they do take a career break or not. Because I think some people do think, oh my God, you know, I want a family, but I want a career, but I want a family, so I'm going to choose that and completely, you know, go down that route. And it doesn't have to be a decision, I suppose.
Yeah. Or even with swapping, like, some kind of sector, right? If, for example, like, for science communication, for instance, right? Imagine you've done your research role and you think, oh, I want to work more in public engagement, things like that. But then after a while, you think, oh, I kind of missed that. I want to go back into doing actual research. Like, any kind of break that you get, I think, from being in the lab feels like, oh, I could, you know, if I leave for a year, like, how could I ever possibly come back and, like, go straight back in?
Yeah, well, that's the absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who've done that, that they're happy to share stories. Mm-hmm. It is a safe space, and it is that thing, knowing that other people have been there. Mm-hmm. And you will be supported. Yeah.
So speaking of which, you know, when we're talking about, you know, getting back into the workplace, what type of challenges do women face in the workplace that sort of Cambridge AWIS can sort of help with?
Mm-hmm. Well, the three big areas which we look at are recruitment, retention and promotion, as I've kind of touched on before. And that comes along with the training, with the access to various people. We also create an awareness of potential items that may come up on the agenda in your future, that there are things, you know, that you will face, there are barriers that have yet to be broken down. And then, as we said, we provide that space to discuss professional dilemmas, share with other people who may have already dealt with something similar. So it's kind of a way of paying it forward, and you will be surprised on how giving people are, how open people are to provide support, to provide advice, and they don't want anything in return, and that's just giving back from having been supported in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things is that you find is that women tend to shy away from investing in themselves, investing in your training. And training is a continuous lifelong activity, and so you have to invest in your professional growth. It's critical, and creating and maintaining your networks. So this allows personal development and allow women to understand their value. So that's through networking, and one of the other major things you will have heard of is the leaky pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's as you go through, certain subjects are better than others, and others, you know, are absolutely anemic when you go from junior through to senior. You will see it in research institutions where there are, you know, female figures of, you know, in professorships are in really low numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you have to have a look at why are these women falling away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's attracting them away, and what can you do to retain them? I mean, there has been movement, but I mean, there was as you may have heard of, the WISE campaign, the National mm-hmm. WISE campaign,
Women in STEM and Engineering.
That's
or,
it.
Yeah.
And they released a report this week, and they were looking at the increase of women in the STEM workplace, and it is in a positive direction, but the change is incredibly slow. And if you look at the tech sector, looking at the past 10 years, in 2009, the number of women in tech were 15.7%. In 10 years, that only went up by 0.7%. Now, that's very slow.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to speed this up. Engineering did a little bit better. I mean, the numbers doubled in 10 years, but you did start with 5% jumping up to 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see there's still a lot to
do. A lot to be done,
yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So why do you think that it takes institutions such as CamiWise to exist and to provide that network instead of, you know, people feeling like they can do that job on their own? I think it's great that people are getting involved with things like CamiWise and that these support networks exist in the first place, and that people are so willing to be open and giving of their time, of their advice and their support. But at the end of the day, you know, is it really their responsibility to do that? Surely the fact that these institutions, these groups like CamiWise have to exist is evidence that not enough is being done on an institutional level, or...
So I think you've hit upon a very important point there, that all places of work and research institutions, there should be gender equality across the board. And that is happening at a very slow rate. If you go back 40 years, it's a very different picture from there till now.
Mm-hmm.
There are far more women's support groups in even specific areas in tech, in engineering, in maths. However, because that change is slow, it is getting on people's radar. And people do give their time because they feel so passionate about it, because they see the impact that it has on an individual level and on a large economic and national level. You know, these are unpaid posts, but it just shows you how people feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to your point, that should the workplace already be doing this? Yes, they should.
Mm-hmm.
But then workplaces should be doing a lot for many other things,
yeah,
for all the protected groups, for age, for disabilities, for gender orientation, you name them, BME, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we are moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And thinking about sort of all sorts of women and minority groups, how does... in an organisation like Cambridge AY's sort of support inclusion in the workplace?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, again, that's quite interesting. CamiWise, I believe, has come to a crossroad about 12 months ago, having to visit what our vision for the future is. And like I said, it would be wonderful to say we're not needed anymore, but we are needed. But as things have moved on, we need to ensure that our message can be filtered to every other group. And in the last 12 months, all our training now specifically specifies that it is open to all genders and is open to STEM and non-STEM. And we've been very, very conscious of that, and trying to make that move to filter that into the other protected groups. Even though we are specific for women in STEM, our message is applicable across the board to everybody.
Yeah, I noticed that on your website, actually, with the workshops and groups, and I thought it was great because you don't often sort of see that type of language, and it's becoming more and more sort of...
Prevalent.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
I just think it's really, really good.
And with that, you have to understand that... there are allies out there that want this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are fathers who are now in senior positions and their daughters are coming through and now they're getting it. And women becoming mothers, or as people move into management and see that there isn't enough talent pool out there to recruit in their research groups or in their workplace, that you need to spread that net as wide as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think that often the kind of discussions that you have around gender equality, people who try to play the devil's advocate, so to speak, are always on, you know, like, things should be meritocratic, things should be based on work, on quality, on, you know, who can do the best in the role. But I think, you know, it's naive to think that there are any barriers that stop people from being considered, or the way that people's applications are interpreted with the biases that we all have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's great that, you know, we have groups that recognize that and kind of give people the tools to bypass that and say, look, okay, yes, there is a system that is maybe rigged against, like the odds are kind of stacked against you in a way. Here's the support that you might need.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's great that organizations like that exist. So how do you think, I guess, we could be encouraging that kind of positive change so that people don't need to have to go through these endeavors at a kind of institutional level? Or what are the things, what are the major barriers do you think that
mm-hmm.
that women and other minorities might be facing in STEM
mm-hmm.
Specifically?
I think there's so much training that you can give to those key decision makers is trying to keep diversity at the forefront of any of their activities, making a case that you want to have the best people there. You need that diversity pool of talent, and it's just making a business case for that, as well as an ethical and moral case for that, ensuring that promotion is based on ability, but making sure that you have enough coverage of the diversity that you reach out to. I mean, if you go into the research arena, ensuring that your papers are cited, you know, you're careful that you're just not going to pick one specific gender on that. I mean, like I said, making the business case, if you look at the revised McKinsey report that was published in 2018, that tells you that if you have senior women on your decision-making boards, your productivity will jump up by 20%. If you have a diverse board with different groups as well as gender, it will jump up between 30% and 33%. That's your bottom line.
And I guess, do you think that then the main obstacle that trickles down to the way that people act in different ways in recruiting or in supporting different people or in, you know, inviting specific speakers, do you think that then it just comes down to these unconscious biases that we have and people acting on those biases? Do you think that's the main issue?
I think it's multi-layered.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are unconscious biases, but there are also explicit biases. You know, there's been a backlash to equality in politics, in economics, in education, in violence, in the women's reproductive system. And so there are implicit and explicit biases. But then there is a thing of making a specific point that I as an individual or we as an organisation will not move forward with this kind of practices. And there's a huge amount of talent out
mm-hmm.
there, as you know.
Yeah.
You just need to look.
Mm-hmm.
It
you
doesn't
need to bother to
yes.
look properly.
And I think
yeah.
it depends on what metrics you judge professional in the field, say, for instance. Because I think, you know, this argument that we'd select people on merit, just because someone's got 100 papers and someone's got 50, that person with 100 papers, because of the way the system is, had access to a lot more grants, got awarded a lot more grants, and therefore made more papers, whereas the other person might be a minority, not be able to get those grants and have fewer papers, but they could be equally as sort of incredibly, you know, talented. And so I think it definitely depends on what factors you judge people on as well. But I guess that's really hard to gauge.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
hard to quantify that.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah,
but I absolutely agree with you. CameWise is here for everyone, and we would like to encourage people to come along, see what it's about. We always have our tea and our cake and coffee, which is a brilliant icebreaker for people to come and meet each other.
These tea times are a very recurring event.
Yeah.
theme. Apparently it's very successful. So if you're thinking of setting up an organization, take their tea.
and the next event that CameWise is coming along is on the 24th of March with Natasha Wilson. And it is looking at influence and impact in the workplace. It will be looking at how you look at the strategy of your decision makers and stakeholders in your workplace and how you try and create a positive, persuasive argument for anything that you need to bring forward, and looking at your status, their leadership, interactions and engagement. And that will be at Lucy Cavendish at
mm-hmm.
8 o'clock. Please do come. And Natasha is a wonderful facilitator. And
so that's open to absolutely anyone.
That's
not
open to
people
absolutely.
From the university, just anyone.
Absolutely. Just
awesome.
Click on our webpage and book for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then following that, on the 29th of April, we have a collaboration with the maths department with Naomi Elemers. That's at 5:30, so please do check us out. We look forward to seeing you all.
Mm-hmm. And where can our listeners find more information on your website? So that's camaywise.org.uk. And do you also post on any social media channels?
Absolutely. Or? Follow us on Twitter. We're mm-hmm. always up to date on that. We're on Instagram and we're on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And give us a shout.
Great.
Thanks. Thank you so much for chatting to us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. It's been fun.
'Thank you for tuning in to this very special episode. We hope it gave you a really good flavour of what initiatives are going on in Cambridge to increase diversity and inclusion in science.
Yeah, and equally, even if you're not in Cambridge, like, we hope it was still useful to hear about some of the things that people are doing, and I'm sure that, you know, universities across the globe are also have similar groups and institutions. And if you are interested in finding out more about any of these organizations, we have linked them all in the description of the podcast. Be sure to go to the workshops that CamAWISE is organizing. If you are an undergraduate woman in physics, do apply to the conference for undergraduate women in physics. I'm not sure, I think the deadline may have passed for this year. It may have already happened this year, but be sure to look out for it in the next years, because I really enjoyed going to that when I was an undergrad, and it was absolutely fantastic. And it also exists in the United States as well, so if we have some random listeners from the US, then I think it's unlikely, but
I think we do, actually.
You do? Oh, right. Well, hello, person. So the conference for undergraduate women in physics is great. And also, there are some other... I think the conference for postgraduate women in physics is actually happened this week. And there are plenty of other initiatives that if you just look for, I'm sure you'll find. So that's great. And yeah, I think it's important to kind of look out for those initiatives, because they're, I think, one of the things that I realized, at least making this episode, was that so many people are doing so many different things. Yeah. And we, you know, we've only talked to the people in the departments around us, mm-hmm. and, you know, we haven't talked to, because we have, you know, limited time and limited travel availability. But there's so many people in so many different places working on so many different initiatives, and now I've said so many too many times, but it's just that there's so many.
Yeah.
So it's worth keeping an eye out for those, making sure that you're taking part in them, because they are there's often a lot of really interesting opportunities if you just look for them.
Yeah, I think it's easy to feel alone, especially if you're in a minority. But if you actually do seek out these things, hopefully you'll be pleasantly surprised by the amount of activism that's going on around you, mm-hmm. perhaps quietly, but it is there.
Yeah, and if you think that it's not happening to the standards that you want, then, you know, I think that the kind of take-home message from today is to do something about it, and to keep people accountable to that, in whatever capacity that, you know, you feel comfortable and you think is suitable, I guess.
Absolutely.
So although the focus here has been on kind of women to mark International Women's Day, we wanted to highlight that it's important to recognize people from all backgrounds, be intersectional. We talk about gender equality and gender diversity, and in recognizing that different people from different women from different backgrounds will face different barriers, and recognizing kind of a privilege when we have it, as for instance in our cases, you know, we are white women.
And making sure that, you know, as Hope mentioned, we don't repeat the same power structures that exist more broadly, and we need to try and be inclusive in all ways. There's a lot of activism going on for people in LGBTQ+ groups, minority background, disabilities. So yeah, the inclusion of people regardless of gender, race and disability is basically absolutely key for scientific progress, as well as building a fairer society.
Yeah, completely. And kind of that's it for now. Make sure you subscribe to us, because as promised, there will be another episode tomorrow, because it is our fortnightly Monday episode day. Woo! So yeah, extra special double episode days, I guess. And we're very active on social media, so don't be shy. If you want to chat to us, please tweet us, message us, email us, like, follow, subscribe, all that fun stuff. And yeah, see you tomorrow for the next episode.